Hey guys, welcome to Pod Strickland. I'm Drew. Schwinn's here. What up, Schwinn?
What up, what up, what up, what up?
And on today's very special Friday episode, we are doing a very late night recording because our guest had to do parenting stuff. So Schwinn and I don't understand this world at all. Like, it's never going to happen. But anyway, he is the Knicks beat writer for The Athletic. He is Mike Vorkunov. Mike, how are you?
I'm in the middle of the wrestling ring, just telling everyone to come get me. So,
Royal Rumble style?
Yeah. Just bring it. Come on. Let's do this. Let's make this the most anarchic podcast in your podcast history.
He's the corporate champion.
Is someone literally DT at the moment?
that was a fun era of WWF for me.
Oh, the corporate champion. There's so many good eras. Well, not really.
I'm Stone Cold when he went started singing from the guitar every 5 minutes. Character instantaneously.
You got yourself a couple of what did he call his beers? Were they just like Steve Weiser or something? I remember he had a separate name for them.
He did.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I just remember when he brought out the Budweiser beer truck and started hosing down everyone. Oh man, that was a great time.
The thing I always enjoyed was like he would crack open the beer and then he would like start to drink it, but he would just like kind of open his mouth and pour it, and it would get like it was like
everywhere.
10% of it would maybe be ingested, and the rest was just like covering his body.
Oh man, those were the days. Those were the days. Yeah, no, okay, so instead of being nostalgic for late 90s, early 2000s WWE wrestling, we have tons of stuff to talk to Mike about because Mike ruined Schwinn's mentions earlier. Was it last week or this earlier this week?
It wasn't even that bad. It was actually kind of funny. But like, it's funny just,
I would like to contest the framing of that. I believe it was Schwinn who went on a long Twitter subtweet thread about me. So I don't know. I would just debate who started what, where, when.
Interesting.
It was a critique of Mike's fake GMing skills. Let's put it that way. He's foisting his Chris Paul fever dreams upon all of us.
Yeah, so there's been so much Chris Paul talk with the Knicks. We spent a whole episode with JB, you know, Jeffrey Blone, on it, and we spent pretty much close to like 2 hours doing that. And
we're not going to do that this time, are we? Like, I honestly will fall asleep in the middle of the podcast.
There's no way we're going to spend another 2 hours talking about Chris Paul.
Don't worry, you don't have to worry about that. We'll spend 2 hours talking about other things, but Chris Paul, that's not going to be, you know, the thing.
Like,
we are going to touch about it, and we will make sure that you stay up till, you know, like 12 o'clock tonight, because it's like, I mean, the kid's going to be up anyway, right?
Listen, I'm on dad standard time. Like, I've been falling asleep at 9:30 involuntarily. Like, if you try to goad me into 2 hours of Chris Paul talk, it's just going to be me snoring for the last 90 minutes.
I got to ask, though, like, I mean, before we actually even get into whether you think it's a good idea or anything, like, I mean, have you heard anything, you know, insofar as what you can hear? I don't know, your interactions, I'm assuming, are far different than they normally are with people in the organization and stuff. But as far as Chris Paul goes, like, I mean, have you heard anything about, I mean, are they Knicks interested? How interested are they? I guess, what are your thoughts on that? Or have you heard anything?
I have not. You know, I think it's kind of, and this is just me, but it seems kind of hard to get a read on the Knicks so far in the new Leon Rose era that we're in. They seem to be keeping things pretty close to the vest. And I think there's kind of like maybe presumptions of what they'll do. But I honestly, like, I haven't heard anything definitive yet. I think it's just, you know, it's almost similar to what they've been saying publicly, the few, I don't know, like twice maybe that they've spoken publicly. It's just they seem to be kind of, you know, harvesting their assets and waiting for the right move. I don't know what that right move will be. And I think, I assume we will eventually get into the should they or should they not Chris Paul, but I don't think there's, I haven't heard anything definitive even about what they'd like to do with, you know, the rest of free agency in the draft. And I know there's been some stuff out there, but I don't think I've even seen anyone report anything definitive either way either.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the only thing I've seen are little tidbits from Macri's newsletter. And then I saw super, super great source Legion Hoops Ross inform us that the Knicks would have interest in Fred VanVleet. I guess
I do want to say one thing though. I think there's something that needs to be said about the term like have interest in, right? Like,
right. Yeah.
I think that's kind of a universal term. I think the degrees and the details of that kind of matter. You know, I'd say that like the Knicks have probably interest in a lot of players, but at a certain price point, they're no longer interested, right? So it's like, what does interest mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, there's also like reasons for stuff like that to get out there, right? Like the Knicks always, I saw one fucking report today. It was like a Montrezl Hill report, and they named like three teams that make sense. And then it was like Toronto, Phoenix. Toronto doesn't even really make sense, to be honest. But Phoenix, it was like, you know, and then it was just like the Knicks. And I'm like, why? That doesn't really seem to make much sense to me. But yeah, I mean, like the Knicks get connected to a lot of guys because if you're an agent, it behooves you to connect the Knicks. And I think this summer especially, it makes sense because, you know, the Knicks will probably have one of the second or third largest amount of cap space in the league with all the kind of thing, at least the reports about things are breaking down. I guess, Mike, like, do you have any read on, you know, I think we're all kind of under the assumption that Taj Gibson will be back in some way, shape, or form, given his connection with Tibbs. But other than that, do you have any read on, you know, obviously they have options on Bullock, Ellington, Payton, Portis, and I'm forgetting one.
Ellington, Portis.
I don't know. No, that's it. Because Morey traded Morris. Have you heard anything as far as kind of like the odds of who's coming back of that group? Or
no, I mean, I haven't yet. I think the presumption is maybe that Portis wouldn't come back because he's at such a high number. I guess part of it too is, you know, I think we have to be like, I've been talking to like, you know, agents and team execs and scouts for other things. And I think some of what's bubbling up is just kind of uncertainty about what this offseason is going to be like altogether, like outside of the Knicks. I think there's, you know, there's like some people that are like, look, this can be a wild offseason. There's going to be a lot of teams like selling off contracts because they're in worse financial situations. And then there's like the other side that says, this is just going to be the slowest offseason ever because no one has the money to do anything. And if you look at the teams that have cap space, even to begin with, like pre-pandemic, I think it was 6 teams that had cap space. And so like that, the pandemic just makes it so much harder to pull anything off. So I don't even know if there's certainty yet in terms of what can be done or how many teams, what parameters teams will be working under. I think the fact that there still is no salary cap set, you know, I think there's some understanding that they're not just going to let it go from like $109 to $80 million, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't think it's like certain yet that they're even going to keep it flat for the next year. Like, so there's so many things that are just kind of at the macro level that make it hard to project at this point what's going to happen.
Mike, how has it been, I can't think of a better way to phrase it, but like doing your job in this pandemic, right? Because I'm assuming most of what you do is like, you know, like personal interaction, communication, networking, and everything. And I'm assuming you've pretty much been home since, I don't know, like the beginning of like 2020, more or less. Has there been like any sort of effects in terms of like networking and trying to like cultivate sources or information or anything along those lines? Like, has there been like challenges that we don't have been like, you know, like unforeseen?
Yeah, I mean, well, sure. This isn't even like without revealing any state secrets or anything. Like, think about how the NBA calendar normally goes, right? The last NBA game was March 11th. Usually you'd have another month, right? I think sometimes source building is maybe construed in this like secretive way or something like that. Sometimes you're just trying to get to know the people that you cover, right? Like, I don't know Leon Rose very well. He took the job for 9 days before the world. Like, that's 9 days that he was on the job. You know, like, you know, some people knew him from when he was an agent beforehand. I hadn't been covering the league that long to be able to develop a great relationship with him. Also, all the other people who came to the front office, like, it's just simple as like, hey, nice to meet you, I'm Mike, you know, like, right. I put a name to a face. And then part of it is, you know, the NBA calendar. There's supposed to be a draft lottery in the combine in May. You know, usually I'd go to that. There's the summer league, there's the draft itself. You know, sometimes you'd have availability, not the Knicks necessarily, but availability after like a draft workout or something like that. So it's all these normal, this normal cadence of the NBA year gets broken away. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a lot easier to just make contacts, just to get to know people, just to like talk to people when you can see them in person and just, you know, have a human interaction rather than something that's a little more stilted, I would say, over the phone or via text or whatever it is, as we've had to do for the last 6 months. So it's definitely made things more difficult. You know, in some ways it makes you get more creative, right? Which I think is good. And I think like sometimes it breaks up, I don't want to say the monotony of how you report and do your job, but it like at least pushes you out of the routine. But it's definitely made things more difficult, for sure.
Do you, do you miss seeing Alex Wolf at games?
At this point, I miss seeing everyone, even Berman.
I was going to ask, even Berman? Wow.
Did you see Berman was having trouble yesterday on the conference call again, unmuting his...
I did. You know, Berman is a classic. I know we've had our back and forth tips about how to do our jobs, but he's a classic in terms of just, you know, he's a monument on the beat, right? Like, everyone knows who Mark Berman is.
I was reading Berman's shit when I was in fucking college, man. That's crazy. Yeah, I was reading Berman's shit when I was in high school.
Yeah, you're about to collect Social Security. I'm surprised you can tweet at your age.
It's true. I'm surprised, but you know, it just wasn't. Tibbs like shocked when he heard like Berman's voice or whatever.
He wasn't shocked. He was just like,
he was smiling. He was glad. He was happy. Like, happy Tibbs. It's that chuckling, laughing Tibbs gif, but like hearing Berman's voice. Well, because they know each other. They, you know, Mark was there. I think covering the team when Tibbs was there as an assistant. You know, 20 years ago now, like. Mark, no, I don't mean that as like an insult. Like, Mark's covered the team for a long time. He is his, kind of his own institution of the Knicks in some way, as other people are. Like, it's just, that's what happens when you're part of the media and people know you and you've covered a team for that long.
I know, it always warms my heart when like I saw that with like Tibbs, and it's just like, oh yeah, it's just like Berman's just, he's been the constant with all this. It's just, it's so nice to see like even old, you know, old 60 whatever Tibbs is like, I remember you when I was, you know, back in my day. So
honestly, it warmed my heart a little bit. Like, it was at least someone with the Knicks kind of smiling at a Knicks media member instead of, you know, like trying to push him away or something.
I guess, like, have you had interactions with Tibbs before, you know, he was hired by the Knicks? Like, have you dealt with him in other day-to-day stuff?
No, I mean, I started covering the Knicks and the NBA in, like, 2017, I think. Anyway, he was a Minnesota coach at that point. So, no, I never really dealt with him. I think I maybe talked to him at Summer League 1 year. I think he was at Summer League summer of 2019 after he was fired by the Timberwolves and he was there for something. So I ran into him at that point, like, that would have been the only time. I just haven't been covering the league that long.
Yeah. So I guess, like, obviously, like you said, there's kind of a lot of, you know, you don't get the chance to, like you said, put a name to the face as you normally would by now, at least with the new coach and all that kind of stuff. But as far as, you know, what limited interaction you have had, is there anything that you can tell us about kind of like how the environment is around the team since Tibbs took over with these little voluntary workouts? I know it's really just started, so there's not like a whole lot going on, but is there anything at all that you've like gleaned from you're kind of being around that situation, or is it just kind of almost exactly what we're seeing and just you have like these 16-minute press conferences and that's about it?
I mean, at this point, it's mostly that, but I would also say, like, you know, I think what happens very frequently in covering sports is that a lot gets made out of a little, right? Mm-hmm. And this happened during the Stella era too, like, and I think I bought into it too, so I'm trying to learn my own lessons. It's just like, sometimes you got to let things play out and keep the rhetoric away from what's actually going on. So, I mean, I haven't been able to see much yet to this point, but also I don't really know what you can make out of 6 weeks of individual workouts, and now we have 2 days of team OTAs. Like, right. I don't think there's much to go off at this point.
Well, there was some, I mean, it definitely was like innocuous, but it's actually kind of interesting in a way. Like, new friend of the show, friend of the Strickland, Kenny Wooten, was like, he made like that tweet about like,
has he been on the pod?
Well, no,
he hasn't been on the pod yet.
No, but
he Kenny
Wooten is welcome anytime on Pod Strickland whenever he wants. He just needs to just let us know. We will make the time for it to happen. But he did mention something about, like, you know, like last year RJ was more or less like did dirty. Was there something to that, like, in terms of like the staff?
Are you asking if Mike has an agenda against RJ Barrett?
No, I'm asking. Yeah. What I'm trying to get at is there actual some truth to what Kenny Wooten was actually saying in terms of how the coaching staff, you know, handled certain things last year? Since, you know, that's the only reference point now that we can do in terms of interaction, because we have nothing since, you know, COVID. I'm just wondering if there's like any sort of like, you know, speck of truth with that, or if you could even like, if you could even like say to anything towards that.
I mean, I took that as more about like where RJ finished in the rookie of the year or team, whatever, not like about how he was treated by the coaching staff. And I guess if we want, we can get into a all rookie team conversation, but that's how I perceive that tweet.
I mean, like, I guess more forgetting, I mean, I honestly don't give a shit about the all rookie thing. Like, I think it's pretty fucking stupid why he didn't get voted in. I think it, like, I don't know. The whole all rookie thing is weird to me, because you got like people like throwing on like fucking warp and block box plus minus. It's like, give it a rest, man. It's fucking all rookie award. Like, we don't need to get, if you want to get taken that seriously, you can have at it. But as far as, you know, like the tweet that he did send, which again, like, this is the stupid shit we have to care about now, because we have nothing else.
You don't have to care about it. I would say that you don't actually have to.
No, you're right. We don't have to.
That's what we get paid the big bucks for.
We get paid a lot of money to do this, though.
So I guess, man, like, what he did mention, though, which I think was just interesting. I mean, again, it doesn't necessarily mean anything, but okay. So like, a lot has been made of kind of the additions to the staff that Leon Rose and Tibbs have made. I know that there was, like, when they hired Tibbs, there was kind of that, you know, a few days before he even got officially hired, there was a lot of stuff about, oh, like, you know, the Knicks are asking to have some kind of, like, input into his coaching staff, and that's a problem. But, like, a lot has been made of who they've added to the coaching staff. So, you know, they got Kenny Payne from Kentucky, highly regarded development coach, big man coach from Kentucky. Then they got Johnny Bryant from Utah, another very highly touted development coach. And I just find it, I think it's like interesting. And actually, you know, this is something that I don't think a lot of people give credit to and maybe even think of, but like, Mike Woodson did a hell of a fucking job in Atlanta developing that team before Budenholzer got there and before he took the Knicks job. Like, what, I think Al Horford and Paul Millsap, both those guys, and Josh Smith, like, they developed into really good players under him. And I think they improved their win total 5 straight years when he was there. So, like, this is like a pretty solid development staff as far as, you know, in comparison to what has come before. And I found the one thing Kenny Wooten has been, he's tweeted a lot the last few days, but what he did tweet that I did find interesting was he said something along the lines of, you know, I think I can learn a lot from this staff, from being a part of this team. And I mean, I guess, like, again, this is hard to for you to answer, you know, again, like, 2 days of team workouts and stuff like that. But I mean, do you, I guess the two-part question. One, did you get the sense last year, and it was reported that Fizdale didn't have any dedicated development staff on his entire coaching staff? Like, did you get the sense last year and kind of through Fizdale's entire time that for as much as the Knicks were talking about development, they were definitely not, you know, they didn't have the infrastructure to really, you know, put their money where their mouth was? And do you get the sense that it is that what they're saying now, there's more to it than just saying, and they actually are, you know, invested into it more than they had been previously?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you remember the last year of Jeff Hornacek, they had, maybe it was also the year before that, they had like two specific development coaches, right? Yeah.
Sullivan, was it? Or it was a big guy, right?
It was Dave Bliss and Josh Longstaff. When Fizz took over, there was no solitary development coaches. You know, it was just a five-man coaching staff. And he said at the time, you know, like, we don't need development staff. All my coaches are, you know, we're all involved in player development, whatever. So that was directly, right, like fewer people, fewer resources devoted to development. And I think last year, at least, Royale Ivy was kind of involved in charge, I think, of player development on that staff. But so, I mean, part of it is in the results. Like, it didn't seem if there was like much player development going on, right? Like, did you see a lot of the young players? I'm not even saying that facetiously. Like, it's sometimes the results speak to the process. And you know, they weren't like the Sixers, they weren't like the Clippers, they weren't like these other teams that have all these coaches devoted just to player development. Or more specifically to player development than like the in-game stuff. I think this year, you know, I don't know if Mike Woodson is there for his player development or not. I think Kenny Payne obviously has this track record of it. Johnny Bryant has this track record of it. Yeah. I think right now, like up until, I don't know, March or whenever the next season starts, like it's all player development to this point, right? Like this is almost a great period for all your coaches, whether they were brought in for player development or not, are player development coaches because there's just nothing else to do. But, you know, I think it was Ian Begley reported that the Knicks were planning on hiring some player development coaches along with the staff that they have now. And I'd heard, you know, like a name here or there. And then, I'd heard that, like, they were going to add analytics people too. And to me, that just shows like an interest and a coordination in building on the margins, right? So it makes me think that they will put more resources, more manpower into player development this year than they had the last 2 years. And I think if you're being like a player first organization, which the Knicks are purporting to be under Rose and William Wesley, that they would do such a thing. So I guess we'll see how it plays out. And that's why I caution, like, let's see what the staff looks like in final first, before we can really, really like pass assessment on it. I don't know that the staff has been finalized yet, just because like there's not really a rush, right? Like, again, when does the next season start? The draft not 2 months.
Yeah,
Mike, do you know who the HR person is for like hiring for like Knicks analytics? Like, do you think if I give you like you my resume? Yeah,
I think it's Brock Oliver. Yeah, just DM Brock Oliver if he follows you, or tweet out and team follow back or something. See if that works.
Okay.
You can just email Mike your resume. You can pass it on to him.
Yeah, Mike, can you do that for me?
Yeah, sure. Do you want me to list do you know how to code? Can you tell me all the languages just so I can make sure he knows?
Yeah, I know how to code Excel.
Okay. Do you do Java?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the Java. I'm drinking it right now.
Can you make a good Netscape website? Like, let's see what you got.
Have you seen the 1996 Space Jam website that's still up? That's me.
Oh, really? Wow. Kudos to you. Great job.
I know. Hey, man, you got to do what you got to do, you know?
You touched on, what was it? I think you said the Clippers and the Sixers. So was it noticeable at that? Like, was it, I mean, obviously you knew because Fizdale himself said it. But even, you know, if he hadn't said it, would it have been noticeable that the Knicks staff was just like, significantly smaller in terms of development and analytics than a lot of, I guess you could say, some of the more progressive and forward-thinking teams in the league? Was it like,
sure,
yeah?
I mean, you can look at like a staff directory first. Like, you know, if one team has five analytics guys and another team has two, I mean, you can probably do the math. You can figure that out. I mean, another way is, you know, this is kind of like trying to break the difference between what you can see and what you can't see. when you cover a team, but like, you know, some player development is done like pre-practice, post-practice, you know, drills, all this stuff after practice, in addition to like, you know, 3-on-3 workouts or whatever. And, you know, every team does pre-game workouts on the floor, you know, 1-on-1 workouts, 2-on-2 workouts, that type of stuff. You know, RJ Barrett would come out and shoot with Judd, I think it's Judd Bushler. Season was so far away, I forget now. But Judd Bushler, I think, before every game. And like, the Knicks would kind of do 1-on-1 stuff all the time. You'd see other teams like have players run 3-on-2s, have players run like 4-on-3s. I think it was the Wizards, like for John Wall workouts, they would devote like 3 coaches to him. And like, this is all about developing skills that more reflect what they do in a game. And that was something that I hadn't seen the Knicks do the last few years, not just last year. And so, look, it doesn't tell the whole story of how they approach player development, but sometimes the things you do see can kind of reflect what's going on as a whole.
Yeah, I actually remember when Fisher got hired, because he brought a lot of the OKC staff with him. Or not a lot, but like, yeah, he brought like 3 or 4 guys. And I remember listening to, I don't even remember what podcast it was, but they were talking about how like it was noticeable that the OKC guys that had come from, you know, OKC with Fisher, they were kind of implementing a lot of the player development stuff that OKC had done, which was pretty intensive before the games. It was like, you're out there on the floor with these guys working through XYZ things every game. And I thought that was interesting. And like, obviously it's kind of interesting to see how, I think Longstaff and Bliss, and there was one other guy, I think, that came from OKC with him. But like, those guys kind of slowly got phased out, but they were never actually replaced. So I guess, like, you know, maybe that's something that, I guess, for fans, it's, you don't maybe keep track of that to the same degree. But in retrospect, it is kind of interesting to see how that all played out and just how that kind of slowly deteriorated.
Say what you will of the Phil Jackson era, and I didn't cover it, I think, except until like the last year. But I'm pretty sure they had a few small wins in player development, like Langston Galloway, Lance Thomas. I think there's someone else whose name I forget. Like, those aren't like huge wins. You didn't turn, you know, Nikola Jokic from second round pick into Nikola Jokic, but Kyle like, Quinn. You know, yeah, maybe Kyle Quinn. Yeah. I mean, but like, you turned guys who were, you got for basically nothing into, you know, Langston Galloway got $20 million. Lance Thomas earned $28 million. Like, when you turn nothing into something, that's pretty good usually.
I mean, the Phil Jackson era has always been and will forever be like underappreciated and always misunderstood. So I'm happy that you brought out, you know, one of the positives in that era, because, you know, some people think it was a disaster or the worst era of Knicks history. I mean, they drafted an all-star. They had they got Willie Hernangómez. They traded Carmelo Anthony.
He didn't trade Carmelo
Anthony. No, that wasn't Phil Jackson.
He wanted to trade Carmelo Anthony.
He wanted to, but he gave him a no trade clause. How can you give him credit for that?
I'm just saying he wanted to, and that's very important to me.
I've had enough of this, Phil. Like, I think Phil Jackson did some good things and probably gets too much shit for a lot of things he did do. But we're not going to keep praising the Phil Jackson era like he did something here. No.
I mean, you may not. I will continue praising it as arguably the best era of Knicks basketball I have ever seen. So,
when did you start watching the Knicks? Like 3 years ago?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that would still not be the best era of Knicks basketball. I don't know. Moving on from Phil Jackson. I guess, like, so, you know, the reason why you're here, Mike, is to talk for an hour and a half. No, I'm just kidding. But, I mean, Chris Paul, like, all right, so this guy, you say you haven't heard anything necessarily about the Knicks level of interest in him, but, I mean, you think it's safe to say at least that there is some interest there, that they're not just going to, like, you know, that they'll at least kick the tires to see kind of what it would take to get him out of OKC, the price of it.
But every team should be doing that, too, as well. Like, it's good. Like, like, you're probably not doing your job if you're not just at least asking Sam Presti, like, what would it take? If he answers 17 first-round picks, you're like, okay, cool. You know, we tried. We asked. But, like, you should be asking.
Should they really ask, though?
Yeah, because you'll never know what you're going to find. Like, you don't know what the price of these things. And I guess that's the problem with this Chris Paul discussion, is just, like, yeah, they should trade for him if the deal is good, and they should not trade for him if the deal is bad. Like, I don't know. Isn't it that simple sometimes? Like, it depends on what the return would be.
I mean, I guess, like, I mean, and this is, I think, where we probably don't see eye to eye on it, but, like, what do you, how positive of an asset do you think Chris Paul is? And I guess more importantly, forgetting, I mean, fuck that, but, like, more importantly, like, do you, I mean, this could, I don't know if this is just how you read it or things you've heard, but, like, do you think there's a robust market out there for him in terms of teams that would be interested, and not just interested, but can give OKC a variety of the things that they would want? And, like, that's obviously not a set scale, because, you know, maybe OKC would prefer to not take back long-term money, but if they take back long-term money, if they get XYZ amount of picks from it, they would be okay with it. Like, but I guess, like, I mean, because when I look around at the league, right, like, and I'm just basing this on what I've read and just kind of like what teams would really be aggressively pushing for Paul, like, the only three teams that I seriously come up with are the Knicks, Philly, and Milwaukee. And Milwaukee, they already had that piece drop. I think it was Eric Neal. Is he the, is
yeah,
he the Bucks?
It was Eric. Yeah, Eric Neal and Sam Amick, and they said that Milwaukee might not be interested because they don't want to go into the luxury tax for him.
And because he has a very strong personality. Please don't leave
that out. That was very strong personality.
I forgot that part. All I saw was the team doesn't want to spend money when it might win a championship part.
I'm sure Giannis understands that.
Yeah, that's very understandable.
They had the lunch, and I'm sure that they told him, look, we can win a championship here, but we're not going to pay for it.
How can we pay for lunch if
we're going to see if Milwaukee can, you know, publicly fund the luxury tax payment? So I don't know. Maybe Milwaukee's out of it. Maybe that's just Milwaukee kind of like blustering its way until they can throw in like every contract they don't want, so OKC takes it back. Yeah, and there's usually I covered baseball for a while, and I think there's always like, when Scott Boras player was involved in free agency, a mystery team. But it's probably like some kind of team that we're not thinking of that decides, okay, now's the time for us to kind of get into it a little bit more.
The Clippers could definitely be like, fuck, we need a point guard, don't we?
Sure. Just do Chris Paul for Paul George and just, you know, let's run it back for each franchise in that situation. But like Philly, the, you know, the Knicks make sense. You know, Milwaukee, if it decides that, you know, has enough money left in its debit account, and I don't know, somebody else, like, I don't think just this contract alone makes it difficult to have like a very strong market for him. Like, there's very few teams that can, pay $41 million for one player next year. And that should limit it, right? I still think that like Chris Paul is a positive asset. I get he's 35 and he makes a lot of money, but you know, he's also still a top 12 player in the league. And like those players are really hard to get. And, you know, part of my whole argument for why the Knicks should at least consider it if the price is right is like, you know, like that's a good way to lock in 2 years of a, you know, top 12 player. Like they've been, you know, the Knicks have been playing this kind of like gold rush in free agency for a decade now, trying to get somebody good. And here's a way to do it. And if it costs you, you know, like arguably very little, like why not do it? I mean, it avoids you again, if you want, from making the summer of 2021 to be a repeat of 2019 or 2010 or whatever you want to do. And if you do get someone in 2021 in free agency to come to you, I think we've learned over the last few years that if a team needs to clear cap space, it can clear cap space. That's what you have all those late round picks for, right? Like, it's not necessarily to draft either the next Pascal Siakam or the next Josh Hystis or whatever. Like, it's to use it as capital to get what you need.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you laid out with that. I think there were three trades. So, the first
let me pull it up if you're gonna rip me. One second.
No, I actually I think like there are different versions. So like the first one is basically like you get Chris Paul for more or less nothing, or very minimal. So it's Chris Paul for Randall, Payton, Knox, and Ntilikina. like
I probably should have included Nilekina and Nox in there in hindsight.
Yeah, I mean, we're all
one or the other, but
Frank Hive over here. But like, I think, you know, let's say like instead of Nilekina, you put the 23 Dallas pick, which I personally like am excited to trade whenever the Knicks trade it, because I'm not interested in keeping a fucking top 10 protected pick for the next 3 years. But like, I mean, let's say that, like, I've at least come around to the idea that, like, okay, if you can literally get Chris Paul for that, I think you, there's like a lot of kind of stuff to think about. But if you're Leon Rose and that deal is out there for you, and you're like, you know, actually, we don't want to give up anything for Chris Paul other than like our vet guys that we don't even want on this team anymore. Like, it's the kind of thing where, like, if Chris Paul gets traded to, I don't know, let's say Milwaukee, and Milwaukee wins the chip next year, that's the kind of thing that, like, you know, already, if you're James Dolan, you see that, like, and it gets out that, like, oh, Leon Rose turned down this deal of nothing, and the Knicks are probably going to suck again next year, you're probably already like, what's this guy thinking here? Because Chris Paul is a big name, he'd get people interested in the Knicks again. What, for good or bad reasons, people would definitely be more interested in the Knicks if they have Chris Paul. I think, like, these are the calculations that GM has to make. And ultimately, like you said, like, I mean, Chris Paul is still, what, he was second-team All-NBA this year, right?
Yeah, second-team All-NBA, seventh in MVP voting. He's like, he's still really, everyone thought the Thunder were going to win 30 games, and they were the 50 in the West.
Yeah, I mean, they, again, I talked about this, I think, on the podcast meeting with Jeffrey, JB, but like, I mean, they had like their net rating of 50, I think like a mid-50s when team with him on the court, and then without him on the court, they were a net rating of like basically a bottom five, bottom three team in the NBA. So, you know, obviously he's still super impactful. And I think like there is value to Chris Paul comes, all of a sudden RJ Barrett isn't facing like, you know, he's not getting the ball against like a stagnant defense that hasn't been tilted and is just hanging out waiting for him. Now he's getting a chance to attack a defense that's rotating. And, you know, Mitchell Robinson all of a sudden is running pick and roll with a point guard that is a master of pick and roll and can pull up shoot and opens up all these levers for your offense and slots in a lot of your young guys into, you know, the roles that they should be in. And I think, like, for me at least, I would want to keep Nilekina in that situation more. I mean, I want to keep him more than Knox to begin with, but especially in that situation, because I think a player like Paul opens up a lot of the lineup flexibility that a player like Nilekina should have, but like we've just never really had the proper lead guard to really utilize that. And the same thing goes with like RJ Barrett, who can play the three, like probably should be a three full time. And I don't know, like I guess like if the idea is Paul helps the young guys on the court so much, it seems a bit counterintuitive to then include like your two of your three most recent lottery picks in a deal for him. Like I understand that you're just kind of like, it's Chris Paul and you're getting them for essentially Frank Ntilikina and Kevin Knox, but it's like, I don't know, that part of it just kind of rankles me, where I'm like, if you're getting him because he's going to help the kids on the court, it is a little weird if you're all of a sudden like throwing them into the deal, you know, willy-nilly.
Well, I mean, it's not willy-nilly. It's like you're going to have to pay something, right?
Right.
Probably. And it's just like, you know, what is it going to be? You know, just throwing in Dennis Smith Jr. in this hypothetical isn't enough. You know, is the 27th overall pick something you'd rather spend than Frank Ntilikina or Kevin Knox? Maybe. Is it worth as much? Probably. I would argue no. So it's, you know, it's just basically, what do you want to do? And it's also, which young players are you prioritizing? And so it's just, you know, just doing that kind of math. And I think Ntilikina would be great next to Chris Paul in this imaginary backcourt. And I think Kevin Knox would benefit playing next to him too and all that stuff. But like, it's, you know, you have to get something away, right? Like there's not really a lot of value to be had on the Knicks roster.
But you are giving something away in what you're giving away. You're giving away OKC's, you're giving away like cap flexibility, right? So like OKC during a time where we're assuming they're going to completely rebuild and blow it up because they fired Billy Donovan, there's been these Chris Paul rumors. The Knicks are providing a space that you can easily dump off Chris Paul, where you don't have to theoretically like trade a bunch of picks or assets in order for it to happen. It is a simple soft landing spot where the Knicks can give you that opportunity where you don't have to sacrifice anything in terms of future picks or assets or cap or anything along those lines. That's why I don't really understand the idea of adding any sort of value to Chris Paul, because you're already providing them a space for Chris Paul to easily like fit into cap space.
I mean, but that's assuming that they're just going to be desperate to get rid of him. And I guess that's the unknown, but I don't see, look, I don't know Sam Presti very well, but just from what I've heard about him and what I kind of have learned about him, I just don't see him making a deal to get rid of Chris Paul just because it's, you know, it's like, oh, well, I guess we're going to move on to our rebuild cycle. Unless, you know, his owner's like, you know, we're not flush with cash anymore. The oil market's kind of struggling. Like, we need to get rid of all these contracts. So if that's his mandate and like the mandate is we can't pay as much for the team anymore and you have to get rid of him, then yeah, I can see that argument. I don't think he'll be in that position where he's completely in a corner. And then I think at that point he'll be able to extract some kind of bidding market for Chris Paul. And at that point, you know, like you got to give up something. And then, yeah, I mean, that's what I would guess that goes.
I mean, fair. I just don't see the market though outside of New York.
The bigger thing for me is like, I think OKC is absolutely motivated to get off Chris Paul this year because I don't think they had any intent. I don't think they were fine being good this past season because, you know, look, these NBA teams that they're more aware of draft classes, you know, 2-3 years down the line than we are a day before the fucking draft, right? Like, they're planning so far in advance. And I think that they were fine with being as good as they were last year because, quite frankly, this draft class is not that great. And I think for them, especially, like, OKC does not have great... Like, they're never going to be a player in free agency, right? And if you're not going to be a player in free agency, you have to be great in the draft and you have to have an asset stash to go make deals. And obviously OKC has an asset stash. We know this after they made the Paul George deal, after they beat Daryl Morey in the Chris Paul and Russell Westbrook trade. Like, they have plenty of assets. They have like 15 first round picks or some shit like that. They're loaded in that sense. But I do think that like they're motivated to get off Paul in the coming year because next year's draft class is, you know, we've talked to people that know a lot more about the draft than we do. You know, like you talk to Spencer Perlman, talk to P.D. Webb, you talk to a lot of guys, and they're all like, this 2021 draft class has 5, 6, 7 guys that if they were in this year's class would go number one. And number two and number three, like they would be far ahead of the LaMelo Balls that we're debating about now. And I think like if, you know, when you have that many people telling you that, to me, I don't think OKC, like this could be one of their best chances at getting a elite star player. And like, do you really want to hang on to Chris Paul making $41 million next year and 43 or 44 and a half the year after that? Like, is that really what you want to do? Or are you just pretending like you're totally fine with this outcome when you have no, you don't really want to do that? And I think like the leverage the Knicks have is like, they can be like, look, like you already got paid on one side of this deal, right? You already got paid to take Chris Paul, who was seen as a negative asset at that time when he was dealt. Like, for better or worse, like, he had a great season this year, and it's crazy how that one great season, which, you know, exceeded expectations, defied expectations, I guess, in a lot of ways, how that can change your value so much. But ultimately, like, the Knicks can go to Sam Presti and be like, look, like, here's your get-out-of-free jail card. Just give us Chris Paul. And whatever, if you have to eat like some bullshit salary to just, you know, we'll give you Dennis Smith Jr.'s expiring contract and the 23 Dallas pick or something. Like I really think like that is valuable in its own way to OKC. Because now all of a sudden they have all they actually would be way under the cap then at that point. it takes out one of your biggest, you know, potential competitors on the market this summer for like salary dumps in the Knicks, because we would just be like taking on Paul's salary basically for going having any cap space this summer. Now all of a sudden OKC can sit there with an additional first and fake asset like Dennis Smith Jr. and like now they can start, they can be a salary dump team and get picks like that. And so I just think like there's more, I think like the Knicks have not necessarily leverage, but I do think like what the Knicks can offer is pretty nice for a team like OKC, and it really frees them up to do anything they want to do this summer. Because and the reason I say like I don't think they have any interest in having Paul next year is I don't anticipate them keeping Danilo Gallinari next year. I don't think that there is any chance that Dennis Schroeder is a long-term Thunder player. I think like maybe at best he'll play out next season there, and that's about it. I think Adams might stay for another year just because his contract is hard to trade at $27 million. But I'm not sure he's a long-term piece for Oklahoma City, and if he is, it's at a very reduced price. I just feel like the Knicks can offer something that no other team that will be interested in Chris Paul can even remotely come close to. And I wonder how much appeal that does have to somebody like Sam Presti.
Well, what I would disagree with is that I don't see Sam Presti as being the kind of guy who says, well, I got paid on the front end of this, so who cares about what the back end looks like? I think he's kind of the guy who wants to compound all the money that he's making. And so he's going to try to extract the most that he can in the next Chris Paul deal if it were to happen. And secondly, you know, like, to get a top five pick, a top three pick in the lottery now, like, they don't need to be a 20-win team. They can be a 32-win team and still get up there. You know, there are other ways of, if like they're trying to manipulate the roster into getting that. You can try to trade Schroeder or Adam. You don't bring back Gallinari. You know, there's also the possibility that if, and again, I don't, this is kind of the unknown part of all this. You know, if business comes into it, like, I don't see them as being a type of franchise that can just afford to bottom out for 2 to 3 years and just neglect what's going on from the ticket sales standpoint, right? So maybe you go into the year with Chris Paul and you try to be relatively not bad and still try to make the playoffs. Maybe like that's in the best interest. And then you use all those picks that you have to try to trade up into the top 10 or the top five, and just offer like 80 picks to the Hawks next year or whatever. And I also say, like, you can also trade Chris Paul mid-season. Like, if this season starts in February or whatever, and they allow some fans and owners are seeing revenue come in, and then they're willing to spend a little bit more, maybe it's easier to trade Chris Paul at the next trade deadline in June or whatever. And some teams know they have a little bit more money to spend, and you have a different type of market for this top 15 player in the league for some playoff team that really wants to make a big acquisition down the stretch. I just don't think it's like, okay, you got to get rid of him now or bust. And part of that is the financial aspect of things. And I don't know how to game that out, because I don't know what that truly is, but I think that should be considered.
Well, this then I think will lead nicely into our discussion we wanted to talk about as well. Like, for the Knicks, why would you kind of like, I don't want to say like cave in, but like, I am going to say like cave into that type of like deal for like Chris Paul when they could just theoretically just sign Fred VanVleet and accomplish a very similar concept of terms of putting the younger players in the right position, but Fred VanVleet isn't Chris Paul.
I mean, I think the argument for it is that Chris Paul's better. And so if we want one of those two guys to be your best player next year, I'd rather have Chris Paul. I think Fred VanVleet still has a few, I don't want to say questions, because that makes it seem like he's bad or something, but I mean, like, we still need to see what he's like, if he's going to be running his own team, if he's the primary offensive option on a team, you know, all that type of stuff. And yes, maybe it'll cost you only money and cap space, but, you know, if you kind of have a deal where all you trade away is, like, let's say this 27th overall pick and contract, like, that's not that large of a price to pay. And he makes you more competitive immediately, like, than having Fred VanVleet does, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that, like, if the Knicks basically just give up, like, the 27th pick and some shit, like, okay, that's fine, do that. But, like, I guess, like, when I say, like, when I said that oh, you know, he already got paid on the front side of this deal. What I mean is that, like, a year ago, if they had done the Westbrook trade, and then they went around the NBA, like, I mean, there were reports, it's not like I'm just making this up, there were reports that literally Chris Paul was untradeable at that time. That, like, no team would want him other than if you attached picks to him, and that's why the deal, I mean, that's why, you know, Morey had to give up what he did, which I still kind of, I don't really understand how Chris Paul was more untradeable than Russell Westbrook, but anyway. Right.
Not basketball genius, but I would rather have Chris Paul in his contract than Russell Westbrook in his contract, even back then.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I agree. I never really understood the pick part of that. But, like, I only say that to say that, like, you know, right now, he is a player that you can move and you can get off that contract 100%. 100% you can do that. But Chris Paul, if you look at his history, has not been, like, the healthiest player in the world. And he was really healthy this past season. But, you know, the three seasons before that, I think he missed at least 22 games in each one. And, like, I just feel like right now that they can capitalize on the fact that they can just dump that money, or they can at least maybe get back, like, sure, maybe they can eat a terrible Al Horford contract, but they'll get, like, a couple of picks out of it. Like, they can make deals like that right now. But once the season starts, you know, who knows? Like, he's not, like, the paragon of health. So I feel very strongly, like, and to be quite honest, like, I think Chris Paul has enough cachet and respect and all of those things that if he goes to San Francisco, I think, like, look, he could have been a bad soldier last year. Really, he could have. If he had wanted to, he could have just pouted and not really put his best effort in. And I mean, that's not who he is. But, like, that he could have done those things. I don't think anybody really would have blamed him or thought ill of him for that. Just kind of, like, because of how the situation unfolded. But he didn't. And I think he's probably earned some modicum of, like, okay, let's do right by this guy. That doesn't mean that they're just going to give him away to the Knicks because he likes Leon Rose and the Knicks have cap space. Like, I don't think that's the case. But I do think if Chris Paul is like, hey, look, like, I don't want to, like, I know what you guys are doing your own thing right now. Like, I mean, they like Billy Donovan didn't stay for a reason. Okay. Like, it's pretty obvious that reason was related to rebuilding. I mean, Woj said as much in his tweet. It's been reported by several other people. I think that much is obvious. So I don't think Chris Paul wants to sit around and hang out with a team that's just rebuilding and isn't, you know, like, are the Knicks a rebuilding team? Yes. Is there more of a chance that if Chris Paul makes the Knicks relevant, all of a sudden actual star players are interested in signing with the Knicks than would ever be the case in OKC? Yeah, I think 100% that's true. And forgetting the Knicks, like, if Chris Paul's like, hey, like, just fine, like, I'll go to Philly. Send me to Philly. Like, I just think Chris Paul has a lot of leverage in this situation himself. And I don't know if any of us, me included, like, I feel like that's part of this equation that maybe doesn't get enough credence. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that, but yeah.
No, I do. I agree with that. I think that, like, if a Chris Paul trade were to occur, he would have some say in how that goes. And I think that, like, the Thunder have shown they're kind of amenable to helping their star players get to somewhere they don't hate when they eventually do a deal, right? So yeah, part of it. But again, these are all just unknowns. Like, and I hate to keep saying that because it sounds like a non-answer or a cop out. But, like, we don't know what Chris Paul wants. We don't know if he wants to play for a contender next year. And you're right. And says, like, hey, look, you know, the Sixers are the best team on the market for me. I know they're interesting. Let's make that happen. I just think that whatever it is, the end result, if Sam Presti makes a trade, he's not just going to be doing it and to do it and just to get off of a contract and be willing to pay whatever. I think that seems to be our main point of contention here, is that, like, I just don't think it'll cost them nothing. So if it costs them something for it to happen, what is that something going to be, and how high should they go?
Well, and I guess, like, how high do you think, like, forget, I mean, I know that a lot of the hypotheticals in here were, like, you know, one of them was, like, if the Knicks are super motivated to get him, but, like, how motivated do you think the Knicks should be to get him? Like, given where they are, all these things.
I don't think they should be super motivated. I mean, like, if they, like, what is, like, motivated? What is super, I guess, like, you know, that last trade that I had in that, in that piece, which was just kind of a hypothetical that I even said at the time, like, this is just way too much, obviously, on its face. Was
Godfather offer.
Yeah, the Godfather offer, whatever it was. It was like Nilakina, Bullock, Knox, the 27, and then the Mavs 2021 first round lottery protected pick. Like, that's a lot. Like, don't go there. You know, and I've talked to several people around the league, just asking them what they thought of such a deal. And they're like, it just doesn't make sense with the Knicks timeline and his contract and all those types of things. And I totally agree. But I think if you trade, you know, the 27th pick and, like, I don't know, you know, some contracts to make it work, I think that's fine. Maybe if you trade, like, as well, you throw in, like,
a second
Frank Ntilikina.
Jesus Christ, Mike. What are you trying to do on this podcast right now? Do I have to hit you with the booze right now?
I think that's probably the high end of it. And as much as I do like Frank, and I think he'll, like, it'll be weirdly one of those things where if he goes to Oklahoma City, he'll probably prosper, and it makes the deal look worse for the Knicks in hindsight, as opposed to, like, if he stayed in New York. But that's probably the far end of how far they should go. I don't think they, even if they did the deal, like, I don't think they would trade a premium for him. I think it would be on reasonable terms, and I think it would be because part of it is Chris wanting to go to New York. I would guess if it were to happen, that's how that would go.
You know, it's interesting when we joke around with, like, Frank and everything along those lines. It is interesting that you bring up, like, if he goes to OKC, he's going to prosper. I think given what he has, like, produced on the court, like, obviously you would trade that type of player, but I just firmly believe he's going to be, like, a second contract type guy, and he's going to make, like, the Knicks always look bad if they decide to trade him. Where, you know, like, you know, when he's, like, 27 years old, he's going to be, like, really contributing, playing really well. It's like, oh my God, how could the Knicks trade him? And then he could, and then he could be like, well, he also, like, stunk it up the first 3 years, and he was, like, pretty bad offensively. So it's like, that's how I pretty much see where it's going and why I wouldn't, like, be quick to, like, trade Frank, only because I think he's going to have tons of value on his second contract, because he's not going to get locked up to anything, like, high, you know, after the season. Like, he's not going to be demanding, like, a max contract or anything along those lines. I feel like he's going to outperform his second deal. And that's why I just would be very hesitant to trade him for almost, like, any player at this moment, even though it makes sense to trade him. Like, he's not, like, an actual asset, if that makes any sort of sense. Like, that's where, if that makes, like, I know he's not an asset, but I think he's going to become an asset, like, 3 years down the road. So that's why I wouldn't trade him, but that's most likely crazy talk, but that's fine.
I mean, listen, being a fear-based GM is definitely the way to go.
No, I mean, I think it's more like, see, like, the way I try to think of it is, if I'm getting Chris Paul, like, who are the players on my team that would benefit the most from acquiring Chris Paul? And what would that do for me? So, like, to me, I think a player, like, I honestly don't know how much Chris Paul would necessarily benefit. I mean, if you're, like, asking me to pick between which player would I rather put into the trade, Ntilikina or Knox, I would rather put in Knox, because I think a player like Frank, if Chris Paul comes, your team is much better. And if your team is much better, a player like Frank, who already has plus value on one side of the ball, and really, if, like, all he does this summer is become a pretty good corner three-point shooter, all of a sudden he's a player that's adding value on both ends of the floor, fits into a ton of lineups, and if you're winning some games, all of a sudden he's, oh, look at this player, he's developing, he's got so much more trade value now. Mm-hmm. And I just think of, like, that as part of why you should not trade him in a Chris Paul deal, because if part of the value of getting Chris Paul is not just getting better, but, and this is something JB touched upon, which is a good point, is that, like, when you get better, all of a sudden your young guys, your young players, their value improves too. And I think a player like Frank would see his value drastically rise if your team gets better, because all, like, you know, you watch like, who the fuck was the guy in OKC? Dort, right? Mm-hmm. This guy, I mean, granted, he had that crazy game 7, which was, like, I don't know what that was. That was wild. He had, like, what, 31 points or something?
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, in that series, they were not defending him at the 3-point line. They were just like, all right, like, you can hang out there. But he was getting minutes because what he provided as just an isolation defender against James Harden was invaluable in that series. And I think, like, you see this a lot. Like, guys that can do that, that you can throw them on an island with these guys in ISO and they can hang and they can really compete and make them work, they have a ton of value in playoff series like this. And, like, a guy like that, like Frank, like, we've seen him several times through his career, like, as far back as his rookie season, he, you know, he was all over Kyrie Irving in a fourth quarter, right? Like, we saw stuff like that from him as a rookie, and we've seen it this past year. Like, he, there was, like, all those stats about the two matchups against Dallas, like, Luka was terrible on the possessions that he was defended by Frank. And, you know, you can go through this, you know, I have an image of, like, D'Angelo Russell being like 0-for-70 against Frank, whatever the hell it was. And it's just like, I think, like, he's a player that benefits a lot from Paul, and in turn, he becomes a more positive asset for the Knicks. So, like, if you're gonna play, if you're gonna get Paul, I just think, like, you have to be careful about which young guys you trade. If not because, like, and it doesn't need to be because you think that they are 100% keepers that are long term pieces, but, like, okay, whose value is gonna rise the most next to Chris Paul? And how can we reap the benefit of that? And I just see Frank as that type of player. And I would be loath to trade that. Dennis Smith Jr., Kevin Knox, Ignas Brazdeikis, who I love, but, you know, who the hell knows what he is. Like, yeah, I think those are players that you should be ready to throw in. And, you know, the 23 Dallas pick and then the Clippers pick. Like, I think those are pieces I'm willing to move in a Paul deal. Frank is, like, definitely the borderline piece for me, which I know sounds ridiculous because you're like, it's fucking Chris Paul. But, yeah, I mean, that's just the one for me where I'm like, I kind of think you got to keep him because he'd become way more valuable, and then you can flip him for something that, you know, maybe is worth a little bit more to you because you furthered kind of where you are and you know that.
No, I agree. I think he would be better off playing next to Chris, and I think that would make him look better and raise his value and all that. I think part of it is also, I don't know if, like, where it stands on the reason for keeping or trading him is his contract status and the fact that he will be a restricted free agent next summer. And, like, you're also at risk possibly, if you want to keep him, pegging yourself to maybe a contract that's worth more than what he's worth. And, like, you don't want to get into the issue of, like, overpaying players who don't deserve it, especially in the middle, which I think is a bad place to be, where you overpay kind of the middle of your roster.
Brock Holler, right? That's like Brock Holler, big bucks.
Yeah, that's why Brock Holler's here.
Yeah, we'll see what he does about that. I legitimately don't know what a Frank Ntilikina contract next summer would be worth, what the right deal is for him. I think you could convince me anywhere from, like, $3 million to, like, $8 million a year, ish.
I mean, if you're the Knicks, like, if I was the Knicks, I would just give him money. I would offer $320 million this summer, like, because he's a
3-for-20.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is.
And I would do that this summer. I don't think he'd say no to that because, you know,
he doesn't really have a leg to stand on
anything. And $20 million is still, like, a nice contract. It's not nothing like that. I mean, $20 million in this economy, you can lock that up. That's not nothing.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's like $50 million in this economy right now, if I'm not mistaken.
You're smart. That should last you forever.
Listen, so,
I don't think that's how those contract negotiations work.
I don't think so.
You know, you can keep it for a while. I don't know. I don't know what the right deal is. Sure, that makes sense. Maybe 3-for-20 works, or, you know, if you play for a year next to Chris Paul and you seem like a lot better, then you have the leverage to ask for, you know, 3-for-24 or 3-for-30 next year.
That's fine.
I mean, you can take 3-for-30. You can better, like, because, like, Marcus Smart is one of the guys. I think he turned down, like, a 440 extension, I think.
And then, yeah.
He, like, you know, he had a really good final year. I mean, he didn't, like, cash in huge, but relatively speaking, but I think he got, what, $452 million? So, yeah. I mean, he did pretty well for himself. So it's like, you know, guys always play that game of, like, well, should I just take the extension, or, you know, should I roll the dice on myself? Should I bet on myself? And obviously, like, that's an individual case by case thing. But yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see, like, not just Frank, but, like, a lot of guys, because, you know, Brock Holler in Cleveland, like, you go through some of the transactions and stuff that they did there, extension and all that kind of stuff. Like, there's a lot of contracts that they played around with, and like they signed extensions for guys like Larry Nance and stuff like that. Like even like Rodney Hood, right? Like they signed him to a contract and they flipped him. They did a lot of like interesting stuff while Brock was there. So I mean, I guess like, you know, just to transition back, like, have you heard anything about like more than what the kind of big pieces that came out after Brock Oliver was hired? Like, you know, do you, I guess, forgetting the individuals, like, do you have any idea of how, like, the hierarchy of the organization is set up now? Like, if there's a nominal, quote-unquote, number two to Leon Rose, I mean, obviously, I guess you'd say World Wide West, but among, like, Scott Perry, Brock Oller, all these guys, like, do you have an idea of, like, where guys stack up on the totem pole?
I mean, I think World Wide West is probably his right-hand man at this point. You know, they have not only just because of his title, but they just know each other for like 30 years, I think, at this point. I have to get my chronology right, but like they've known each other for so many decades and they are so close and good friends that like he didn't bring him in. So, you know, West is the middle manager in their front office, right? Came in at a very high level. And then I think he has all these voices that he listens to. You know, Walt Perrin when it comes to the draft, Frank Zenon, somebody he's known for a while when it comes to pro personnel, like Scott, he listens to him and looks to him for help in certain things. Like, you know, during the coaching search, I think Scott was, you know, doing some of the interviews and helping to arrange interviews and stuff like that. So everyone kind of has their role, and Brock, you know, is the cap / analytics / strategy side of it. So if you have to ask me like who the number two is, I would think that it's kind of West there, and everyone else kind of has a voice that he listens to and he takes in, and at different times maybe someone else's voice rings louder than others.
So Mike, is there a reason why that you don't like Killian Hayes?
I'm just gonna go down. You know, the Knicks have drafted a French point guard before. Look how that worked out.
I think it worked out swimmingly, I would say.
It worked out better than if they had drafted Dennis Smith Jr.
That is true.
Yeah. no, I actually like Killian Hayes a lot. Like, I watched some tape of him. This is me wading into draft prep. I think this was like May or June. Little did I know there'd be 18 more months to go. And I think I like Killian a lot. I don't know. To me, it's like, I always say, okay, who's the best prospect in the draft? And that's who you should take wherever you are. And I think there's a lot of ways to acquire a point guard. And you don't like necessarily have to go all in on a point guard this summer, especially if it's not specifically the right one for you. I'm not completely wedded to the Knicks taking Okoro over Killian Hayes in this hypothetical that I created where they trade up to 6. But I think that should
be a great trade. Great negotiating. OKC negotiating.
I think if you can get someone who has the potential to be a really good wing, especially along with RJ Barrett, it's okay to make do a point guard by signing like DJ Augustine in the offseason, or signing Fred VanVleet if that's the way to go, or trading for Chris Paul and getting your point guard that way, or even waiting until next year's draft to get your point guard. I would just go with whoever's the best prospect on the board whenever you're picking, rather than like going all out for a point guard just because you need a point guard.
No, that's totally fair. I think right now, at least Schwinn and I are leaning towards the Knicks should take a wing as well, like in this draft. I think it's more for Schwinn, it's Devin Vassell. For me, it literally doesn't matter because I don't know.
I think Vassell too. If Killian Hayes is on the board, I'm taking Killian Hayes. I think he's the best prospect in the draft, so I would take
him. You think he's the best prospect in the draft?
Yeah, I think he's the best prospect in the draft. But like
the only thing that gives me pause about throwing out that kind of superlative is the lack of like very good athleticism kind of makes me worry a little bit. And I wonder how like truly how truly great you can be in the NBA as a point guard if you're not like a great, great athlete.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's like the greatest athlete, but I think like when you're talking about a 6'5" lead guard who has, yes, the right hand needs to come along, but you know, you look at like the passes he can make, every pass out of a pick and roll. He looks, I mean, he has mid-range scoring down extremely well. Like, he couldn't shoot. He shot like sub 30% from three last year. I think his overall true shooting was like 58, 59. So he can still, like, he knows how to manufacture points efficiently, even without the three-point shot. And then, like, more than anything, like, he is the only lead guard in this draft, at least at the top of it, that has legitimate defensive value. And I think that, like, you know, is he an elite athlete? No. Is he an average athlete? I think he might be more, I think he's closer to average than a lot of people think. He's not explosive, that's for sure. But I don't think he's got, like, his lateral agility is pretty good. That's why I think he's pretty good on defense. He's a smart player. I would bet on him. Like, I understand the argument for LaMelo, but, like, I think LaMelo is going to be a pretty bad defensive player initially, and can probably grow to be okay, whereas I think Killian Hayes could be a legitimate plus on both sides of the ball. And for a lead guard, that's pretty rare. And then you just talk about, like, at his size, the things that you can do defensively with him at the one, RJ at the two, whatever, another wing. Like, there are just a lot of interesting kind of variations that you can throw out there. So, I mean, I would love to take Killian. If he's at six, I would be pretty annoyed if the Knicks didn't take him. But, like, you know, I also understand that this draft is a lot of people, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder in this draft. So, like, you know, the rankings are all over the place. So, like, is there an argument for a core over him? Yeah, sure. Like, I can't deny that. It's not like some bananas opinion, as much as I would like for it to be. I can insult Mike on the podcast here. Yeah, I mean, it's fine. Like, I just like Killian a lot. I think even if I went wing, I think I would go Vassell over Okoro, but Okoro's a big boy, so I get it.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of draft. And, like, I don't pretend to be a draft expert. Like, I'm not just going to be out here lying to people like I'm watching tape all the time. but I like, my read on this draft is, like, there are so many, as you said, it's, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. There are so many people with different players that they like more than others. So, you know, if they took Killian Hayes or if they passed on Killian Hayes at, like, number eight, I'm not going to be like, oh, that's a dumb decision. They just passed, you know, or they took, like, an obvious great player in the future. I think really it's just, you know, it's going to be a lot of, it's going to be a lot of intel work for the Knicks, as much as, like, what those guys are on tape and what their synergy numbers are. It's also like, who are they? How, you know, what's their backgrounds like? And there's so many ways that it can go. Like, I just don't know what the top 10 is going to look like. I just feel like it can go into crazy directions. There's probably like 15 people. If they go in the top 10, I wouldn't be surprised. 15 people in the top eight, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. It's, and you know, like you said about kind of how they have to, you know, do a lot of their due diligence, like, it'll be interesting to see who they pick, because obviously with Kenny Payne there, like, there are, you know, there's an idea that, like, somebody like, you know, Tyrese Maxey from Kentucky, maybe they're higher on him because they have better intel on him than other players. And, like, yeah, he was like, he was like their kind of UK, he was kind of Kentucky's, like, secret weapon in recruiting. So he's actually familiar with a lot of guys that didn't even go to Kentucky. So it'll be interesting. I would imagine that he might have a bigger say than he normally would in the draft process this season.
Well, I mean, they just have a direct resource, right? Like, instead of talking to a college coach about Tyrese Maxey, they just talk to Kenny Payne about Tyrese Maxey. It's nice to have that in-house. And, yeah, he probably knows a lot of these guys as well as some of their scouts, just because, like you said, he recruited them. Like, Kentucky recruited, I would guess, probably, like, most of the really good players in the draft, because they're at some point really good prospects. And that's nice to have for an assistant coach, especially for a draft that, like, could have the least intel out of all the recent drafts. I don't know. Like, I think this draft is going to be fascinating for all the reasons that everyone's talked about, just because, like, the group of players is so weird, and also the circumstances surrounding the draft are so weird, and everyone has to be super creative about how they scout these players.
They're going to do the draft on, like, Skype or whatever, right?
I think like, so. Oh, you know what? I don't know anymore. I don't, like, things are changing so quickly about, like, who's allowed inside and outside and what you can do and where. Like, I don't know. What if they just decide, I think, what, the draft is November 18th as of now? What if they're just like, let's do it in L.A. and have an outdoor draft?
Well, that's totally possible. I was just wondering how it would be for, like, the virtual green room. Like, waiting, like, someone would be there and just be like, oh, man, he was supposed to be a top five pick. And now he fell all the way to, like, 35. Like,
I don't think they'll do a virtual green room.
That just makes me sad if that's the case.
Isn't that what the Emmys just did?
The Emmys? The Emmys happened?
Right, was that the Emmys last night?
Yeah, I think it was the Emmys last night.
Sunday night? When was Sunday again?
I was watching football.
Yeah, there's kind of a award show.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was. There was too many good sports happening. I was watching like the Patriots and the Seahawks, and then there was that awesome Nuggets Lakers game going on. Then the Emmys was like, oh shit, I guess I care about the Emmys. Not really.
No, I mean I didn't watch it, but I saw that there were in the highlights. They just like there were people in their houses receiving I saw somebody. I think it was Mark. I think it was Mark Ruffalo. Like won an Emmy, and in his he's in his house holding up an Emmy award. And so how does that all work? Like, did a guy show up like 2 hours before showtime and like with an Emmy and Mark Ruffalo's like, I think I got this one. I may win tonight. Like, I don't know. That's a different question.
Do you think, see, now I have questions about the idea of like shipping an Emmy. Like, how does that exactly work? Like, what's the type of insurance?
You just do it with U.S., you know, the U.S. Postal Service because it's so reliable now.
Yeah, the boys in blue?
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
I just imagine just like you know just
hey,
someone,
they slowed
like
some, down voting so they could ship out the Emmys quicker. That's yeah, really that's
what I'm just saying. It would just be, I just imagine like some interns going in like, hey, I need to ship out like 100 Emmys, and he has to like wait in that line that takes forever because there's only one person working, and then when you finally get there, they're like, oh, and it's time for my break, and you're just like, oh man, the post office. Like that's how I just imagine it being, and then they had to get the they had to worry about the tracking numbers and all that. Yeah, that's what I'm picturing right now. You know, I'm painting a great picture.
Well, I guess I don't have much else, but I guess if there is one question, like since we fucking talked about him so much here and on Twitter, we've had our beef, our Twitter beef. Like gut instinct, like if you had to put money down, is Chris Paul and Nick opening night, whenever the hell whenever the next season starts.
I'm gonna go out there and say yes.
Oh, okay. How much money would you put on that that answer? Like if you're at the I'm saying if you're putting I'm just saying like how much money how comfortable would you feel going to like the Bellagio right now and being like, I'm putting X amount down that Chris Paul is going to be.
I'm not very comfortable. I feel like saying like he's not going to be a Nick this year is kind of boring. So why not just say yes? And like, there's a non-zero chance of it happening. I don't really know what the big market for him is going to be. So why not the Knicks? Like, listen, think about the way that Leon Rose has gone about this offseason so far. Everyone that he's brought in is someone that he knows. Someone that he has a pre-existing relationship with. Why not the guy that he was the agent for the last like 10 years or whatever, and make that kind of the first big move to set a tone for the type of players that the Knicks want are trying to turn the organization into.
I think I'm going to go to the Encore here in just outside of Boston, and I'm going to put like $2,000 down on Chris Paul becoming a Knick.
You can't just like draft on a. There's no like online sports book you can go to?
No. I'm specifically going to the casino. I'm going to the sports book and I'm going to, you know, this, just like put
like
down
a,
the money.
Like,
yeah, exactly. Just be like $2 million and just like I have to go to the sports book. I have to get a helicopter there. I have to get a helicopter to Foxwoods. Like it is what, like that's what they got to do.
Yeah. I tend to think that I think he's going to be a Nick. Yeah. It just feels like. I don't think like the smoke is complete bullshit, and I think, you know, like you mentioned, all the people that Leon Rose has brought in are people he's had connections with. And yeah, I mean, I think there's like legitimate arguments for why the Knicks would feel like, you know, he's somebody that they should bring in. I don't necessarily agree with some of the logic. I think that if you want to get in a veteran hand, that's fine. I'm not convinced that like giving assets up for a 35-year-old, regardless how good he is, I'm not sure that's the wisest move. I actually don't think it is, but I think there are ways to make the stupid move without it being completely moronic. And that's where I think the Knicks, if they can hit that sweet spot, I will definitely talk myself into it and eventually come to the conclusion that it is a genius move that the Knicks have made.
Oh yeah, you'll be wearing a Chris Paul Knicks jersey by the start of the season.
Yeah. CP, what he's five, right? He wears, is it five that he wears, or is he wear three?
Yeah, three. CP5. CP6.
Yeah. CP6. Yeah, I'll get a Chris Paul number three jersey. Why not? Sure, let's do it.
Get a nice jersey from Modell's.
Well, I have a J.R. Smith 8 jersey, so maybe I can like find a way to convert that, you know?
Yeah, that works. You can figure that out. You could definitely do something with that. Mike, is there anything you want to plug at all while you're here?
I mean, listen, subscribe to The Athletic. If you haven't yet, why are you not doing it? I think we're doing an offer right now where you can get The Athletic for $1 a month. I don't know what you can get for a dollar anymore these days. So that's how cheap it is. So if you go to theathletic.com/Knicks, you can go click on a story, sign up there. I think it's a pretty good deal. You can read about English Premier League soccer like I do, just because we offer all the sports.
I'm pretty sure I can still get a can of Arizona iced tea for a dollar. So
true, you can.
Yeah, and for $2, you can get the iced tea and The Athletic. So do both.
Schwinn, do you want to plug anything?
I wrote a little thing with Prez on Tyrese Maxey. He's a player I really like, but I'm not sure how good he'll be. He can do a lot of shit. Doesn't necessarily do all those shits very well. So pretty intriguing player, but yeah, definitely check that out on the Strickland if you haven't. And other than that, nothing. That's it.
Yeah, I'm gonna plug the Emmys that happened. Whenever it happened, see who won best drama and best actor in a comedy or whatever it is. So go check that out, and go check out the Strickland. Make sure you're following all of us on Twitter. You have it bookmarked on whatever internet browser that you decide to do. Make sure, if you haven't given a 5-star review yet of Pod Strickland, I mean, just go ahead, just do 5 stars and just, you know, put like great in the review. Like, we'd really appreciate that. Or you could just do 5 stars and just be like, this is terrible. But like, either way, like, just make sure it's just 5 stars. I don't care what you write. Just make sure that's 5 stars. And that's our show. See you till Monday.